Welcome back to Forget the Box, the ultimate web series podcast. I'm your host slash terrible community director, Brie Castellini. And did you miss me? Yeah, that's right. We got a season two. If you want us to keep bringing you these incredible interviews like today's episode with Steph Wachneen, please remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or your preferred podcasting app. That and personal recommendations are really the only way a show like ours grows, and we could not be more grateful for what you wonderful people have done for us so far. But on to today's episode, where Steph, who you might know as the producer and co-creator of Carmilla, a lesbian vampire adaptation which spawned three web series seasons and a feature-length movie, talks about interactive storytelling and answers the question that many of us are thinking. Is transmedia dead? Let's find out. Hello and welcome to Forget the Box.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Brie.
So can you tell us who you are and what you make?
Who I am? Well, let's see. My name's Steph Wachneen and I'm a producer. Right now I'm freelancing and working remotely for Shaftesbury, which the company I've been with for the past 6.5 years. I'm the co-creator and producer of Carmilla, the series, seasons 1 to 3, as well as the movie. And hopefully the, you know, TV adaptation we hope to get on the air this year.
Very exciting stuff. So can you tell me about Shaftesbury and what you guys do there?
It is one of the largest production companies in Canada. And we have everything from, you know, Murdoch Mysteries, which is a primetime show on CBC that's been going for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
And we've done everything from Google Glass Games. We have a VR division. We also have a horror series on Netflix called Slasher. We've done Carmilla, which is, you know, one of our branded series. And then since then, we've done about 6-7 series, digital series with brands. So definitely a lot of everything. And we're constantly experimenting with what are the new ways to finance series outside of a traditional network order. Sure. And that goes for everything from digital to fan pre-sales to international co-productions. We're seeing a lot of those kind of lead the way now. And transmedia storytelling as well.
Yeah, so we're definitely going to talk more about Shaftesbury's sort of ethos in terms of interactive and transmedia storytelling. But first, I want to talk a little bit about you and the journey that it took for you to get to this place.
I actually come from theater, so I had my own theater company, and we did a couple fringe shows. We did some. The thing is, and I went to McGill, and I think what was interesting there is that all the theater companies kind of had to operate entirely independently. So we had to apply for funding within the school and then produce the shows. And that kind of gives you the tools to be able to just do it elsewhere. We also did a show in the south of France in the Avignon Festival. And yeah, I love theater. I miss it dearly. And that kind of definitely gave me the tools and the materials to apply to film school, which I went to afterwards. And then I did 2 films while I was there and a little bit after.
So what made you decide to make the switch from theater to film?
Mostly because when I was younger, I was obsessed with Alias. Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Garner, fun stuff, spy shows. And I remember like distinctly thinking there's 2 options here. You can either be a spy, which was not going to happen, or you can make a show about spies. So I'm still on that trajectory today. And I love television. I'm a self-professed fangirl, and I always want to make the things I want to see. So I love TV so much. And that's where we are today.
One story that you told during your Starable AMA a few months ago, I want to just retread briefly because I think it's such a great story, that you got your job at Shaftesbury because you met the CEO in an elevator?
Yeah, that's correct. It's one of those elevator stories.
One of those classic professional meet cutes.
Yeah. So the CEO was up in the elevator because I was interning at the network called, it was Showcase and Shaw back then. Now it's Chorus. And she had a script in her hand that I had read, but instead of talking about the script, I kind of thought that I could be interesting to them if I was in the interactive division. And I knew that company had an interactive kind of side of the company. So I just said, I love that script. And, you know, there's so many things we could do on the transmedia side for that series that was in development. Because the show kind of centered around the video game industry, there was a lot of potential for transmedia elements. And that kind of caught her eye and then kind of started there 3 weeks later.
Wow. So you you happen to just get in the elevator at the same time? Like, walk me through every moment, because this seems unfathomable. Oh.
I would also kind of go bring them up. So when they said this one from Shaftesbury is coming, I'm like, ooh. And then it turns out when I saw that script that I had read it. So I kind of knew who she was and what the company was. I didn't expect that to happen. And then my life. So
that's really exciting. What year was this?
2011.
2011. So how did you know, like, what was your first experience in like transmedia and interactive storytelling? Like, when did you recognize that that was a thing that was starting to happen?
I think it's very, what's specific to Canada is that it's changing now, but there are kind of television funds that augment the broadcaster envelope. And to access them, you actually have to create a rich interactive element. So okay. A lot of companies did it by necessity almost, but that also pushed a lot of us to experiment with different platforms and integrated and what they called convergent narratives. So when I started at Shaftesbury, I was kind of in that department, and we were doing the kind of side web series for shows like Murdoch Mysteries or The Listener on CTV. And we were also applying for experimental funds where we could really kind of go into what can't we see on the broadcast series that we could do in transmedia. And that was always really fun. So for instance, to give you one example, Murdoch Mysteries is a quirky police procedural set at the turn of the century in Toronto and a lot of steampunk elements to it. And what we tended to do in the convergent or the transmedia elements is do whatever they could never do in the broadcast show. So for instance, one season we did a kind of quirky one-off five-episode digital series where Murdoch was sent to the year 2000. And then it's kind of like making an IU, like an alternate reality fan fiction, come to life, because we got to see that character in the present day and follow that through a mini series. And again, that's something that could never have been done on the broadcast episode, because the story never allowed for that kind of fantasy. So that was a lot of fun. We also did some live events. We did some ARGs. When Google Glass was there, we did a defunct Google Glass game. And that kind of working on those for broadcast series also informed how we wanted to create digital series from the get-go. There were lots of companies just throwing money at digital and trying to see what would work. Uh-huh. And one of the great success stories of that time was, of course, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries. And watching how that was made, that just kind of took what worked on YouTube, took the format and applied it to scripted narratives, kind of really, and that's what led us to Carmilla.
Totally. So that's really cool. I want to touch on the thing, though, that you said that in terms of getting funding, there was the requirement for a convergence mm-hmm. for interactivity. When yep. did that go into effect and why?
The fund was kind of mandated to ask companies to look to the future and say, what are ways that you can involve like the second screen or apps or games? How can you expand the experience past broadcast? Because they wanted the people receiving the funds to look past broadcast. And that's changing now because there's been a lot of convergent projects that just don't get any traction with the audience whatsoever.
Right.
Because it is, there are different audiences in general. Some shows are much better suited to it. You'll see that Wynonna Earp, for instance, mm-hmm. did, they kind of followed their more popular character on the series of like FaceTime and yarn narratives. So it was, the audience was already there to kind of go the extra mile.
Sure.
And that's not really the case for a show like The Listener that we had on CTV, which was like a straight up, slightly paranormal procedural. Whereas Murdoch, go figure, has a really healthy fan base all over the world. And they're like, they'll gobble up all those
That's
things.
Really interesting. Okay. Cool. Let's go through Carmilla from sort of the start to finish in terms of the case study of development. Because what I really want to talk about today is transmedia, is looking to the future. Because I think we've mm-hmm. sort of hit like peak transmedia, I would say, was like back in 2014.
Yeah.
And we've certainly seen a decline in series that use it. But I don't necessarily think that it deserves to be sort of shown the door. So I want to hear from you about Carmilla and then about what you think the future of this interactive industry looks like. So Carmilla first, where did that come from?
The fun thing about Carmilla is that I was tasked with finding our own Lizzie Bennet Diaries. And me being me, a gay who wants to see gay things, especially in the sci-fi fantasy genre. Mm-hmm. And so we also wanted to do something that was kind of fandom, just like that we knew had the elements that some shows have fandoms for, if that makes
sure.
sense.
Can you define those?
Essentially creating a show that has a slow burn OTP. So we have two characters that will fall in love throughout the course of a season, a bit like Lizzie Bennet, a bit like Carmilla, you know. That was really, and that was something I was personally like super, super excited to do. And then my friend Ellen Simpson, I was looking for like public domain novellas to do something like that. And Ellen mentioned Carmilla. Have you heard of this old like vampire novella? And then I looked it up, and this was like almost a year before we started doing this. So it was just floating in my mind. And then when the time came to do that Lizzie Bennet thing of ours, I kind of went back to Carmilla and thought this would be, in pardon my French, this would be fucking perfect. Because here we have two characters that are fascinating. We have a slow burn relationship, and we have so much like subversiveness and old ideas about sexuality and feminism and allegories. And there's so much to mine there. So then, and that originally was going to be a project that we just did in-house. Like we were going to shoot it in the office. And it was just about the time, and it was just around the time that we had started our branded agency that was going out to clients and saying, we want to do kind of scripted things with you so you can do something different than an ad for the same price. Then we had the good fortune of pitching Kotex, who were interested. And then there was like a longer pitching process. It was through the agency. There was like four or five different companies to pitch to kind of get the okay from the agency, the media buyers,
right,
the brand, the marketing side, the shopper marketing side. And then they gave us a little bit of money to shoot season one. And we also pitched it from the get-go. They were interested in kind of what they call a 360 approach. So there would be extensions of the series on multiple platforms. So the plan was always to kind of have Twitter character Twitter feeds. And that's what I gravitate to in transmedia. It's not kind of lore transmedia. Mm-hmm. It's more character-driven ones. So we can continue the banter and see them interact and whatnot, right, and at the same time drop some hints of the plot moving along. So we actually started the Carmilla and Laura Twitter feeds about 2 months before the release of the show. And that was a lot of fun. We also did an experiment with Wattpad that didn't quite work, but it was interesting to try, which was another character kind of giving her thoughts about the school and what she saw of Laura and Carmilla.
When you say that it didn't really work out, do you mind talking like what you think wasn't quite right there?
Yeah, I think we can, because the other transmedia were the characters that we kind of grew to love throughout the series, we gravitated towards the Twitter and the Tumblr feeds because they interacted so specifically with the show. So one of my favorite examples is that when Carmilla is captured in season one, Laura and the gang take hold of her Twitter feed and start tweeting as if she was her and she had mysteriously gone on an Icelandic vacation with like terrible Photoshop and whatnot. So then there was that really fun moment where you have a different story that someone's saying on transmedia than what's on the show. And that was so fun. That was so, so fun to do. And I think one of the better examples, it kind of adding to the show, especially because as the series progressed, you saw how their social media interactions changed. You know, they used to tweet about each other, but never directly. It was like constant subtweeting, which is a lot of fun. And then, you know, then you see how they start converging and talking to each other online, which mirrored the development of the relationship in the show. The Wattpad thing didn't quite work because we were also kind of directed by a company to work with someone who was native to Wattpad, which makes sense. But I think then there was just a huge learning curve of her not knowing the show or not fitting the same style of writing. It felt a bit like a different story and not one that brought much joy, I think would be a good way to put it.
So if you were to do something different there now, knowing what you do, would there have been a different strategy? Would you have approached it a different way?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I think it's always, you know, you got to try things and then see if they work or not. I'm not sure if back in that day on Wattpad, it was mostly straight fanfic and original stories. There was a lot of like boy meets girl standard romance, and the queer stuff didn't quite, like it didn't have a community to tap into on the site. I think that's different now. So maybe it would have happened differently now. But at the end of the day, what we noticed is that we were sending all the traffic to Wattpad and we got maybe like 10 hits from Wattpad to the series.
Interesting. Okay. So what other transmedia properties did you guys work in?
In season three, we had one of my favorites, which were the Mel podcasts.
Can you, without so many spoilers, do you mind explaining what that podcast was?
Well, at the end of season two, some students found themselves in a crater below the school in a very hellish-like situation. And then one character that we know and love, because she's particularly snarky, started a podcast deep within that Help It. It was happening at the same time as season three, to the point where the podcast was referred to in the series and the podcast was also responding to the series. So that was a lot of fun. We also got to hear characters that we didn't necessarily have the space for in the digital series. So it was nice to kind of continue some of the characterization there. And actually, what's funny is that a part of our season three budget got slashed. This is all the details I can kind of now say, which is fun. And we actually did not have money to do the podcast, but we decided to do them anyway. That's why they were all done, like, literally in the office and with no professional audio mix. But you know what? It adds to the fun. Sometimes you just gotta do it.
That's really interesting. So was it like there was just no budget to put into, like, producing it better? Like, how does it work where they're like, I don't think we have the budget for this, and you can do it anyways, especially within the confines of, like, a company? Was that kosher? Was that, like, fine with everyone as long as you could keep the price down?
Our budget was higher for season three, and then for other things I can't really talk about, it got kind of cut by a significant chunk got cut, and one of the first casualties were the podcasts. The thing is, we had already written the series with the podcasts in the digital series. So we're like, we can't cut them now. Let's just try to do them with the resources that we have here and just go into contingency for, like, paying the actor day rate, you know, something like that.
Can you think of any other transmedia interactive platforms that you guys use? You've talked about Twitter, Tumblr, Wattpad, and podcast.
Twitter, Tumblr, Wattpad, podcast. And we also only release the podcasts on YouTube. Just the audio over black, just so that we could link back and forth between the videos.
Did you ever consider doing, like, an RSS feed and, like, having that go to iTunes?
The thing is, because the podcast was so literally transmedia heavy, it was so inextricable from the series, it didn't make sense to launch it at its own podcast. We actually did develop a fully different scripted podcast that we shopped around for a while.
In the Carmilla universe or just a separate property?
Yeah, in the Carmilla universe. And that was in between the film and season three.
That's interesting. So I have some specific questions about your strategy in developing those platforms. But really quickly, you mentioned that there are two kinds of transmedia. You said character-driven transmedia and lore transmedia. What would you consider lore transmedia?
Yeah, I would define that more ARG-like.
Okay.
So for instance, you have what they did around Lost. So they'll put numbers and fans have to kind of clue the pieces together to find another piece, and they're driven more by the mystery and the desire to solve a game. It's more of a game approach rather than a story approach, and ours was more story driven, and I think that's why people also connected to it, because it feels like an extension of the characters. And again, the trap there is also to put too much. Like, there's certain shows that just don't need it, you know. And we've definitely seen, when we say peak transmedia, I think it's because a lot of shows have just done it to do it rather than because it organically fits the series. And we've been guilty of that as well.
So when you say that, and I definitely agree that, like, the reason that we sort of hit peak transmedia is because a lot of shows were doing it when they didn't necessarily need it. If, from your experience of, like, professionally doing transmedia, what do you think are the markers of, like, a story that does or doesn't benefit from a transmedia element?
I think if there's a question of tone, if it's more campy and a little more fandom friendly in nature, the story-driven transmedia will do well, like Carmilla, like Wynonna Earp. Legends of Tomorrow, I think, would do well if they wanted to go that way. And then where it doesn't work well, shows with a more serious tone, because I think the audience doesn't necessarily need it or want to. That's a good question. Or shows where they kind of assume the audience will be interested and go ahead and put a, you know, a big puzzle to solve that doesn't really need to be solved. The interest is not there, you know. Like, Westworld is a good one for transmedia because the show is so quote-unquote mystery box driven, to the point where the show doesn't even make that much sense because it's all about the mystery and less about, you know, what the story is. That's a show that does well in transmedia, and they have a really fun transmedia. Like, the number you could call, I definitely called it. You know, you can pretend to hack into the sites and the corporation. And then for web series, it's really difficult to, like, maintain it. And another problem is that some people start and then stop. And it's like you either fully invest or don't do it. And that also comes down to how many accounts you create. But in season two, we definitely had a couple more. Like, we had the voice of Silas. We had the newspaper of the school. We did the official the official Twitter of the La Fontaine character.
So did you ever experience like pushback in terms of like the types of experiments you wanted to do? Was there ever a point where people were like, this might be too far?
Yeah, definitely. I think for the amount, because we also have to make sure the amount of work that's put in is like corresponds to the budget and the time allotted and all that not fun stuff.
How do you measure that in like fan interaction on a Twitter account?
You can't really. That's part of the, that's where we got dinged because we loved Carmela so much. We were always putting like way more effort into Carmela than some of our other shows because the audience is there and it's fun to, you know, speak to people.
So yeah, so then from that business perspective then, like you don't have to give me specific examples, but like, you know, in terms of like defending the ROI of the more experimental stuff that you don't have like a guaranteed path for just because it's never been done, like how do you explain that to sort of more, you know, traditional media folk?
You just have to hope for the best and really pitch them why it's important to the whole experience. And it's about the quality of the interaction rather than the number. So as long as you keep going back to quality over quantity, there's a case to make for anything that gets people really invested.
All right, so let's start to talk about some strategy, because I think that one of the things that people worry about, especially now that Peak Transmedia is over, is that they're worried that the kind of multi-platform storytelling is going to be hard to follow for fans. And certainly that's, I'm sure, a concern of more traditional media folks. When somebody says, this sounds really confusing, what is your sort of defense to that?
I think that in a way it's a little condescending to fans. Like if they want to follow a story, they'll follow it. You know, when they say confusing, maybe they mean there's too much or it's too scattered. And I do think it's important to have a streamlined, you have to answer like why it's here, what's it doing, how is it moving the story forward, what does it give you, and then put yourself in the shoes of the audience and like what are they going to get from this. And from that you can see, you know what, this one's a little superfluous, let's just get rid of it. Do we really need Instagrams? Like at the beginning, we thought it would be fun to also do character Instagrams, but then we'd be a little less agile because we wouldn't have the actors on hand to take specific in-character photos, right?
And also Instagram's harder to schedule too.
Yeah.
So your response is basically like, it's not confusing, like you're just being condescending?
Yeah, I don't think it's that confusing. What I did like, some series did, and we tried to do something similar, is do a transmedia recap of the week. So in Historify, yeah, and then you put everything together that is important that happened.
Okay, so I've got actually a couple of questions from our community forum, community.starable.com, where filmmakers gather and where we sometimes host AMAs, which you are a part of. Web series creator Jules asks, one problem I've had in the past is having really cool or cute interactions happen on transmedia, but then no watchers end up seeing it. Do you have any suggestions for how to promote your transmedia better?
Maybe it's focusing on the official feeds and making sure the official feeds retweet the transmedia. The official feeds can comment on the fictional ones so that you can boost it. But that also comes back to finding your audience in general. Like the more people watch the series and are invested in the transmedia, the more we'll want to seek it out.
So in your opinion, do you think that the way that the marketing funnel should go is it should always start with the series and then the transmedia should be extra?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Did you ever find that you built audience through the transmedia itself that funneled back to the show?
The only way that happened is on Tumblr, because you're able to kind of tag into other fandoms and maybe got some people in that way, but it was really minimal, if any. And then Wattpad was supposed to be a funnel,
right?
Because we were also like supposed to be on the main page or get more traction this way, but it's like we didn't see that. That could have worked, you know? Yeah, if it had been the right story for that platform at that time, when certain things were popular, you know.
Okay.
But it wasn't a One Direction, like, self-insert.
You did mention, though, that you launched the Carmela and Laura Twitter accounts, did you say 2 months before the original series?
Yeah, 2 or 3 months, I forget. But you kind of saw the characters before they went to Silas University, and that was a ton of fun. And that wasn't meant to necessarily gain an audience before the show. It was just so that after, people could go back from the beginning and, like, retrace those steps, which was a lot of fun.
So you never intended that to, like, be the impetus for people to find the series? You always relied on other methods for that?
Yeah, especially because Carmela didn't follow anyone, right? So she wasn't going to get people to ask, like, ooh, who's this that just followed me?
Right.
Laura maybe a little more, because she's so, you know, intertextual in the way she speaks, and she mentions a lot of shows and literary TV allusions. So you always have the chance of people from those fandoms seeing it by character design, but it's hard to tell who would have found it from that.
And was that ever like a discussion of like, we want to reach people through the transmedia?
Oh, yeah. always, especially when you're in a company. It's like everything's got to have a reason and why and how right. are we getting more eyeballs? How are we getting more eyeballs? And sometimes you're rationalizing it and sometimes it's true.
So how did that get sort of, how did that get rationalized? How did that get settled?
I think once the series blew up, so did the transmedia, and then they kind of had their own value.
So obviously you had like the support of a traditional company behind you, but what do you think was sort of like, how do you think you struck fire with Carmilla in like the early days before anyone knew, you know, anything about these people and these characters?
Yeah, we had no ad buy whatsoever.
Oh, really?
So yeah, we had no ad buy in season one. We didn't even have money to do a proper sound mix. Like it was a down and dirty, and we shot it in 4 days. I don't know if you knew.
The whole season? So,
the whole season, 4 days.
Dang. So no ad buy. So given that transmedia wasn't going to, was such a big part of it, but wasn't really intended to be a marketing sort of mm-hmm. arm.
Transmedia wasn't the marketing. I think what was key was the outreach. Yeah, we really set out to reach like 50 potential fans a day. So between me, Carrie, who helms social media, and Ellen, you know, mm-hmm. and me and Ellen already being in those kind of fanish you know, queer women fanish circles, we kind of had people who we knew would be interested to reach out to. And then it's always about, you know, reaching out to people and saying, hey, this just launched. You may or may not like it, but maybe you'll want to check it out. You know, we thought we'd have a lot more uptick with the Pretty Little Liars fandom than Orphan Black. And it turns out it was the opposite. We had a lot more Orphan Black than Pretty Little Liars.
Interesting.
So we kind of did outreach to every show that had a kind of, you know, lesbian, queer fandom or characters that were similar.
Were you on Reddit, Tumblr? Where was this outreach taking place?
Not Reddit. It was mostly Tumblr.
Okay.
And some Twitter, but mostly Tumblr, because we were able to like post about Carmilla and then reblog with another similar show or something in that, but straight up ask, just like ask box all around.
Okay.
And it was like posting on forums, pitching after Ellen back in the day. Definitely gave us a big boost in terms of visibility within the community.
Okay.
And then it's also, you know, the chemistry between the actors and the gifts started speaking for themselves. And that's when, you know, it kind of snowballs. Once people start recommending the show to other people, you know that something's working. And that's when we were kind of trying to get more people to pitch it to other people. So first it was getting people to watch, and then it was getting people to talk about it and kind of incentivizing that.
How do you incentivize that?
For instance, there was one fan who we really liked, who I knew from previous fandoms, who did like these really amazing fan vids on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So we gave her like a tiny clip of a future episode that hadn't aired to put in her video. And then she made a vid on her channel, which reached X many of her followers. Yeah. And then people saw like a new clip and it was really exciting and all that fun stuff.
That's really interesting. Obviously, like it's easy to get cynical when you're going through just hundreds of communities and just posting like, hey, this is a thing.
Oh, yeah. You're screaming into the void.
How do you A, make it feel less void like, and B, make it feel less sort of obnoxious to those receiving it? Because I think a lot of people are shouting into the void all at once. And it's both about breaking yourself apart, but also not sort of falling into the more cynical side of like, please watch this thing. You have to watch this thing.
And that's why I think what helped is that we never kind of did a value judgment in the outreach. It was never like, watch our amazing show. It was more a targeted approach. So for instance, someone had a post about Carmilla, which was an original public domain property. They had a post about Carmilla, the original lesbian vampire, on Tumblr. So I reached out to that person because she had posted about Carmilla. There's a chance she might like the series. Mm-hmm. So then I'd say, hey, you posted about Carmilla. We did this modern adaptation. You might want to see it. But it was never like, this is a good show, watch it. It was, hey, similar interests, maybe you'll like this. And I think one mistake that people do, especially in the independent community, is only tweet from their own accounts.
Right.
So for instance, if you have your own web series account and you tweet about your episode, who's seeing it? You're not sure it's getting seen. So most of the work should be not in creating content and posting a certain number of days. It's about outreach and trying to make those like meaningful conversations. That's only the fan outreach part. Then there's the whole like influencer outreach part. Like, who do you know that has clout within a certain community,
right,
that you can reach out to? So for instance, Union Metrics has a good system where you can see the ripple effects of Tumblr posts. Is that what they're still called? Yeah, they have this really fabulous tool where you could see how far a reblog went, and then you see the clout of certain users in terms of the hashtags or the fandoms they're in. And that was really helpful to pinpointing people And also by virtue of me and Ellen being in fandom, we already kind of know how those circles operate.
Sure.
So for instance, if I was working on a gaming web series and I have no idea how that gamer fandom works, it would be a lot harder than, you know, someone who is queer, who likes these similar types of shows. I know how to pitch it because I want to see it. And then there's the whole outreach to outlets. And then it starts with smaller blogs.
Right.
And then smaller review sites. And then you kind of move up the chain that way. And that all has to happen like simultaneously. It's like the fan outreach, the blog outreach, and then the press outreach all at once. So thankfully we were like two or three people just like going ham.
In like the first month that Carmilla was like online, how much time do you think you and your team spent just on outreach?
Oh, a lot, like all day. All day. Yeah, all the time. I think one thing that I always remember is you got to be as creative with distribution as you are with creating it. And I was also seeing, you know, there is a trend of literary vlog series and these people watch each other's shows. There's an actual interest in that specific format, and that definitely helped us. Even though then it moved more to like a general queer fandom centric, and we had most of our audience. Sorry, my dog's like around and playing with toys. What's interesting is that very soon, most of our audience had actually never watched and followed a web series.
Hmm.
It was mostly a TV and TV fandom audience. And the vlog series audience kind of left us mid-season one, I'd say.
Really?
In general.
Left you? Why do you think, why do you say left you?
Because at some point, it wasn't, we weren't retelling Carmilla. Like the novella became the contested history of the main character. So it was more of an original series than it was a retelling like Lizzie Bennet Diaries
right.
was. Where a lot of people, I think, watch these shows because they're so excited to see the new take on this character as it happens in the book.
That's really interesting. All right, so let's turn now to the future, because like I think that we also probably hit peak literary web series a while back. At this point, I think I've seen like four different adaptations of every single Shakespeare play.
Of every single book, yeah. And it's very Western. You know, I'd love to see blog adaptations of works from Asia and more indigenous folklore. Like that'd be a lot of fun. I feel like we've seen all the Western canon done to death now.
I definitely agree. I guess a question I didn't consider asking, but now I want to, do you think that, so you specifically said vlog retelling, do you think that there is something to specifically the vlog retelling of these old stories? Or
yeah, I think that's why that struck a chord, starting with the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, because it was a format that was not available anywhere else. As soon as you make a traditional digital series, you're competing against every SVOD, every Netflix show,
right,
that even a lot of Netflix originals can't get seen because there's just so many. So you're competing for the same eyeballs, whereas the vlog series were a very distinct format and the market wasn't saturated. So if you started a vlog series, there was a good chance that the seven other vlog series audiences would also watch yours. And that wasn't the case for regular web series.
Got it. At this point, though, do you think that vlog shows are played out?
That's a good question. I think a part of me says yes, and a part of me says maybe not. I think it'd be interesting to see more original vlog series that really kind of use the format and the long tail. I think what was different and useful about the vlog format is that it allowed us and allowed a lot of people to do, you know, 10 to 50 to 100 episodes. So you have more long tail to tell story as opposed to a regular web series that people do themselves will maybe average between 7 and 8. And it's kind of a flash in the pan.
Do you think that there is like a comparable interactive style that might be like the quote-unquote new vlog series, something that couldn't exist on normal networks but is perfectly at home on the web?
That's so interesting. Yeah, you know what I always wonder about fiction podcasts. Will they take off more or not?
What are your internal monologues say about that? What do you think?
A part of me says yes and a part of me says no, just because the same way that scripted is not native to YouTube,
right?
And it will always be like the redheaded stepchild that will never be favored by algorithms and will never get better. And the only way that a lot of blog series worked is because they had a lot of content output and they had the direct address format and it was styled like YouTube rather than styled like a show on YouTube. Fiction podcasts, I feel like a lot of people, and sometimes including me, it's like you're used to listening to people talk and you're not used to listening to a story because it feels too audiobooky. But I think there's definitely a middle ground there where, like Night Vale, they use the medium of the podcast with a host, but it's a fictional story.
Almost like found footage podcasting.
Yeah, I still don't know if it's going to like move or not. Then there's also the chat bots that kind of Wattpad's doing with their app called Tap.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Check it out. There's Tap and there's Yarn, like two kind of chat bot stories. And some of them, Wattpad, by virtue of its existing audience, like will bring some people over. Remains to be seen if it can, if some of those stories can stand on their own. Yeah. And then I'd love to see more like VR series, but some that really use the medium. So like, there's a reason why it's shot like this. It's not like, hey, you can move all around.
That makes sense. Do you think that there is a concern that doing something that's so unique to the web actually hurts you in your ability to sort of quote unquote move up the ladder to more like mainstream formats?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a trap that most people fall into. It's like, if the story, like Carmilla is the least TV thing. It was like a vlog series with low production value at first, but like wonderful actors and writing. And it's now, you know, it's moved on to movies, moved on, there's TV interest. Whereas other ones, other digital series that were more TV-like from the get-go, like an old one we did with like Stargate cast, kind of that was the end of the road. I think it comes down to the creative and the interesting nugget there. And now you see like Gimlet Media is turning a lot of their podcasts into series. Dirty John's coming out. Homecoming just came out. There's bound to be a lot more because IP is IP and everyone's just like sniffing for a story somewhere. So no, I don't think it stops you in any way.
Do you think that transmedia social media accounts are played out?
Yes, when they're not used necessarily. When they're used well, there's always going to be room for them.
Yeah, it's not like people have stopped tweeting. So it's not like you're going to stop wanting to hear those sorts of thoughts from people.
Exactly. It's like, do you want to hear the character speak? Then yeah. If you don't,
and that might be a problem with the character, less than transmedia.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like with Lost had a huge transmedia, like ARGs and games, and like gamified things are always going to exist. Did all the Lost knockoff shows, like, you know, Flash Forward or this or that, they also had huge transmedia things. But since the show didn't take off, neither did the transmedia. So it's a bit of a parallel thing.
All right. So my final question about the future is, I think the big one on everyone's mind. One more thing. What is your pipe dream for the future of digital indie content? So not content that's going to eventually move somewhere else, but content that exists for the web, on the web, and to continue for the web. What do you think the pipe dream is?
I love it. For more companies like Rooster Teeth to continue doing what they're doing and establish a real direct-to-consumer model of making shows. And it's really difficult because the cost of production, like a lot of web series are undervalued and they've been made not for market value. So it's difficult for a business case to be made. However, when you have the audience, it does pay for itself in a certain way if the story can handle that model. I don't know if I'm making sense anymore, but basically I want more companies like Rooster Teeth who know their audience, cater to it, and are able to raise enough money to make the content that the audience wants to buy.
What do you think are the like major players in monetizing digital content moving forward? Do you think it's brand deals? Do you think we're going to go back to advertising models? Do you think it's a subscription-based thing like a Patreon or a direct streaming service?
I think it's a mix between AVOD and SVOD. So definitely subscription to fund future content, which is difficult because then where's the revenue? It's a mix of everything. It's like, and it's the same thing for TV now. It's like it's 10 revenue streams all at once. There's like AVOD, SVOD, directional, transactional VOD. There's like paying more if you want to see more, exclusive material that you can purchase for more. There's merch, there's live events, and it's all of that at once makes a digital company able to survive. Ooh, and the last thing I would love, is more Netflix and Hulu licensing short form and putting it on the platform. So like Red versus Blue, no, or Ruby is on Netflix. One of the Rooster Teeth series is on Netflix, which is great because it kind of legitimizes the form by putting it there. And I would love to see a lot of the big SVOD players license those and put bets on them. Not in the upload your own thing like Amazon is Prime Direct, but I mean in the main kind of subscription package. That would be fantastic.
So any final words of wisdom to the indie creators wanting to make serialized digital content? Inspirational words in general?
Inspirational words in general.
Is there hope?
Keep doing what you're doing. There's definitely hope. And you know what? One thing that I do think about a lot that's interesting is that if you look at all the web series that came out of YouTube and then did move to TV, like that all could have been YouTube Red Slate, like Insecure, Broad City, High Maintenance, like that was there before Vimeo. All of those shows started on digital platforms. Half of HBO's slate is web series, right, that have moved to TV. So you don't even need to have a huge amount of eyeballs to get press and a calling card. So the biggest piece of advice, I think, is know what you're making it for. Is this a show that you're designing from scratch to work as a digitally native show like Red versus Blue or Carmilla? Or is it a calling card series, like a high maintenance, that's meant to go elsewhere? Like, and it can't, it's hard to do everything at once because the model is going to be different. How you shoot it's going to be different. How you distribute it's going to be different. So just know exactly where you're putting it and why, and who's it for, and have fun. And like, congrats on making a thing, because it's really hard. And that goes to you, Bree, as well.
Thank you. Well, that's all that I have. So thank you so much for being here with us, for offering some hope in sometimes what feels like an increasingly hopeless digital landscape.
Ooh, last piece of advice. Look outside of North America for digital buyers, because there are like German networks, for instance, looking to acquire web series, things like that. So just look outside of North America in general. There's lots of opportunity there.
Well, cool. That's an exciting final bit. So I am going to stop recording now. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, if you like this episode, subscribe to Forget the Box on iTunes and leave us a kind review. Next week, we're talking to Jeremy Redleaf, creator of the show Odd Jobs, which landed him on the front page of CNN, won him a Streamy, and got him an agent. That's right, you're gonna want to learn how someone might entice an agent from making a web series. Tune in next Tuesday. But until then, thanks again for listening to Forget the Box, and thanks to Anna Eichenauer, at Queer German Girl on Twitter, for our theme music.